Thank you, choir. The scripture lesson for this morning's message comes to us from the Gospel according to John. I'll be reading from the 15th chapter, verse 9 down through verse 17. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. No one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends, and you are my friends if you do what I command you. I do not call you servants any longer, because the servant does not know what the master is doing, but I have called you friends, because I have made known to you everything that I have heard from my Father. You did not choose me, but I chose you, and I appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, so that the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. I am giving you these commands so that you may love one another. Here ends the reading. May God grant us wisdom and courage for interpretation. They say context is everything. Whoever they are, I think they may be right. For example, a person could say the exact same words, and yet because of the words being said in a different context, they might hold vastly different meanings. Let's try it. Suppose you show up at a dear friend or relative's bedside that has been extremely ill. And once you enter their hospital room, you say, "I hope you are well. I hope you're doing okay." Now, those words might carry a different meaning than saying the exact same words in passing as small talk as a customary friend that you see almost every day who, by all observations, is relatively healthy and vibrant, and yet you happen to bump into the store and them in the store and you say, "I hope you're doing well. I hope you're doing okay." Same words, different context, different levels of meaning. We've been exploring the dance as a metaphor during the current sermon series. Dancing can have so many different meanings as well, the same activity, but when done differently or in different contexts or different places, it can have profoundly different meanings. For example, when your favorite song comes on the radio and you're just hanging out among friends and you're feeling lighthearted and goofy and you just kind of do a little dance, it has an entirely different feel than two newlyweds just after their wedding at their reception having their first dance together as a married couple. The newlyweds, they might be cutting up and acting silly and goofy too, but there's a sense of formality. There's a sense of the fact that this is to be the first time of many. We hope that these two people will dance together along life's journey. The gospel, according to John, is unique in that it almost always carries with it a sort of double-layered meaning, because, in a way, the writings in this gospel seem to carry with them a sense of having more than one context. Many scholars agree. This gospel is different from the books we call the other gospels, the synoptic gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And part of John's distinct difference is that the author had a different theological agenda. But the other part is the fact that it was written approximately three generations after the time of Jesus' ministry. So when we read John's gospel, we hear its words sounding in at least two completely different contexts, two different settings. First, we hear the words in John's gospel unfolding as a narrative that tells of Jesus' ministry unfolding as it happened the first time. You know, just like the author of John tells the stories. But second, we feel the imprints of a community of Christians some three generations after the time of Jesus' ministry who have been wrestling with many aspects of their own faith stories, even as they are recounting these stories of Jesus' life and ministry. They were starting to wonder, by the time they assembled and put together these stories, why Jesus had not returned yet, why they, as followers of Jesus, still endured great hardships, and why they were doubting themselves substantially, even as they put together these stories about Jesus, second-guessing themselves, you could say. So you can see why context would matter a great deal when the author puts these words on Jesus' lips that we heard just a moment ago. Abide in my love. Abide has a very special significance for people who feel as though they are hanging on to faith by a thin thread. Abide is not a word that we use very often in our modern lives together, but the word here, abide, is meant to encourage its readership, the members of this community, to hang on, to endure, to keep on keeping on, and to try their best to find and renew that deep, lasting connection to the love of God and the teachings of Jesus by continuing to practice them and continuing to live them out. I'm so glad the author didn't say, keep on agreeing to the right propositional truth statements, you know, the right ideas about God or Jesus, because that's how your problems will all be solved. And yet that's how so many Christians today attempt to live out our faith, right here, between our ears. No, instead, deep, significant, authentic, lasting connection will happen. We will abide, if you will, as we put the teachings of Jesus into action. It's really simple. We're the ones who make it hard. Do you do what you know to be right, and you'll find this connection, I think, is what Jesus was telling the disciples. And if we're smart, we'll hear for ourselves. You'll come home to yourself, I think, what he was telling them. And you'll come home to God when you recenter yourself in a sustainable way, which, by the way, is loving others, just like Jesus showed us how to love others. And then the next thing the author puts on Jesus' lips, these words are especially important. And again, as John does, they're laced with a double meaning, a double context to our modern ears. When he said, I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and your joy may be complete. Joy? Now, joy is not a topic, quite frankly, that many of us like to discuss. If we're honest, that is. Because I think we mistake joy for happiness, and when we mistake joy for happiness, we get it all wrong. Remember the double meanings and the double context I've been trying to draw your attention to so far? Joy can be exactly the same way. A person might experience the joy of a moment, for example, when you have a really good day, when something goes your way. It might feel like joy. I would suggest it's probably happiness. But there is also a much deeper, more complex, more profound joy to be found. Take, for example, something you may not consider to be joy until you think of it this way. The deep abiding joy that a son or daughter might feel when their parent, who is elderly and has been suffering with terminal cancer, who has lost tremendous amounts of weight over periods of months, perhaps years, and has been in a great deal of pain for a lengthy period of time. Think of the deep abiding joy they might feel when their terminally ill parent finally passes away. They're not giddy, they're not outwardly silly or happy about it, but in a deeply abiding, truly, authentically joyful kind of way, even amidst their sorrow, there is deep joy in knowing one's loved one is not suffering any longer. There's a sense of sadness that comes from not having them around anymore, but there's a deep abiding joy in knowing they're not suffering, that they're in a better way. Can you just imagine The double context I've been talking about from John's writings, as Jesus told his disciples, I have said these things to you so that my joy would be in you and your joy would be complete. Joy? He's drawing near to the time he'll be tortured and executed, and by now in their lives together, his life with the disciples and their journey, things are getting very tense. People are turning on Jesus, and in the face of death and torture, Jesus is talking about joy, not because joy is surface-level happiness, but because true abiding joy exists even right in the middle of death and torture. The second context of these words, again, are the third generation Christians who are wondering just how much of the teachings of Jesus they must be getting wrong, how they must have blown it since they're still having to focus so much on enduring and hanging on. They've not been bailed out by Jesus returning as many thought they would. And so for these third generation Christians putting together these words and the stories of Jesus' life, it seems to be moving at a snail's pace. And there's probably not a lot of surface level joy to be found. But there's more than one context. In fact, there might be more than two contexts. There's more than two audiences, I think, because there's another group of folks hearing these words about joy that I want to talk to you about today. Now, it's you and me. Modern disciples of Jesus, we read these words, I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and so that your joy may be complete. I think it's especially difficult to talk about joy. For one, I don't ever feel that I personally have mastered the art of living life consistently from a joyful place, at least not all of the time, despite my best efforts. For another thing, like I've said, joy can be misunderstood as happiness, and so when you start preaching or teaching about joy, some people automatically assume what follows is going to be shallow, fleeting or temporary. But let me ask you a question. A deep, deep, abiding kind of question. Where do you find true joy in life? In your life? Where do you, my friend, experience a deep, abiding sense of connection to who you truly are, to who you think God is, and to your faith? I don't have lots of specific suggestions for you. I'm sorry. I struggle to figure this out many days for myself, but I think it's worth exploring for the few minutes that we have together. I think for those with an eye and a heart for social justice, joy can be a particular challenge. Because once a person becomes aware of all of the layers of injustice that are out there in this great big world of ours, and opens our eyes to the fact that these injustices, we're not just talking about one person treating another person unfairly in a bunch of isolated incidents, but actually that there are many systems at work within our world that perpetuate things like poverty or discrimination of any kind, racism, for example, in the full gamut of all the heartbreaking situations that we become aware of. For people with an eye and a heart for social justice, it becomes incredibly difficult to do two things at once, to work against injustice while simultaneously experiencing deep, abiding joy. And yet, by Jesus' own teachings, I think we have to assume it's not only possible, but vitally important to find joy even while working against evil and injustice and oppression in whatever forms they present themselves. I will confess, some of the stuff lately has made it really hard for me to find joy. I turn the television on a National Day of Prayer, and hypocrisy bugs me worse than anything. And so to listen to our president give advice on praying and spirituality and theology on the same day that there have been three different changing stories about how he or his staff paid a porn star to keep silent about their time together, I find it hard to be joyful. It's easy to get critical. It's easy to get negative. It's easy to think, well, this is so disgusting, and it is. I find it hard to be joyful as our state legislature gets together and basically ignores teachers for weeks and those saying, hey, you know, we're kind of in trouble with education, and kind of give some things, but then you find out in the private conversations is pulling back on some of the promises. It's hard to be joyful. It's injustice. It's corruption. There's not a lot of things good. And then they passed two bills this past week that sound like they want to turn into the old Wild West around here and discriminate against single people and same-sex couples for trying to give homes for foster children and adoption. I don't understand it. It's a terrible turn of events. I can't see how it would be good for anyone. So quite honestly, it makes me less than joyful on the surface, doesn't it? You to hear about anyone being harmed, that's always my question when I hear things happening. Who's getting hurt by this? Who's getting hurt by this? Because I think God calls us to be people of compassion. But quite often, it's easy to get a case of heartburn, to get frustrated. If I want to ensure heartburn and frustration when I drive from place to place in my pickup truck, I can just leave the radio on the news, and I can count on a good case of heartburn by the time I get to where I'm going. Because there's always someone being hurt by the goings-on in the world. Does this kind of thing ever happen to you? Do you ever feel so burdened down by the weight of the world's problems that you almost forget what joy must feel like? I think Jesus' disciples must have felt this way. The more they learned what he was trying to teach them about being compassionate people who were tuned in to the pains of others and being sympathetic, the more weight they felt from all of it. The more Jesus taught them, the more tense things were getting at the same time, because people began to turn on Jesus. Added to all these burdens of the world, their own personal burdens. And let's be honest, joy sounds pretty far-fetched in some moments of our lives. You know, add to the world's problems our problems, the personal stuff we carry around when finances get tight, or when our marriages are suffering, or when parenting exhausts the last bit of positivity in your entire body. Surely I'm not alone. Joy? Really? Joy? Can we just talk about survival instead of joy? Because that just seems so superficial and fake. But the truth is, at least I think according to what Jesus was teaching, we don't have to choose between joy and just surviving. We've been programmed to think we have to choose between having joy and just surviving, but the truth is, we don't. Because the kind of joy Jesus was talking about isn't the surface level, fake smile kind of joy that can be confused with positive thinking or temporary happiness. Authentic, deep, abiding joy comes as we give and experience love. Listen for the word joy. I'll read it to you again in our scripture lesson, and then hear what comes next. I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. Now listen, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. No greater love than this, to lay down one's life for friends, and you are my friends if you do what I command you. I think what Jesus would want us to remember about joy is that the greatest joy we can experience in life runs underneath the surface of our life circumstances, a little deeper than where we normally look for it. We spend most of our time looking for joy right at the surface level. But deep, authentic, abiding joy is usually found down a little deeper, below the circumstances of our immediate situations. For example, rivers on the earth's surface are easily seen. We can see them even without a boat. We can see them driving around in our cars. We drive somewhere, we cross a bridge, we read the name of the creek or the river on it, and we say, well, there it is. Duh, it's a river. It should be there. We expect it to be there. If all's going according to plan, it has water in it. It's a river. But there are many rivers. We call them aquifers, sometimes, which in many cases are not seen. These waters are underground, and they're water supplies, which actually bring refreshment, life-giving water to even more people and places, and yet are undetected by so many of us. These underground, under the surface bodies of water, they flow in the deepest, darkest places, and so they're out of sight. They're deeper. They're out of mind. And so many of us, we go about turning on our faucets, and we're actually relying on these deeper waters that we don't actually see, and so they just come out when we turn on the knob, and we have water, and we don't always know where it comes from. I think of these deep, dark, unseen, cool waters when I talk about joy. Because just like joy, we don't make these underground water supplies exist. In fact, we don't even know they're there many times. We just happen to discover at some point, when we get it right, that those bodies of dark, cool, refreshing water have been underneath our noses, underneath our feet, all along, sustaining us, providing nourishment, even allowing us to bathe in it. Because you see, joy is not found by setting out to find joy itself, like the rivers on the surface level. But rather, joy is the byproduct of laying down our lives for our friends. Joy is a byproduct of self-giving, self-sacrificing love. It's much deeper beneath the surface than the rivers on top of the earth. To return to the dance metaphor, in closing, maybe we've been waiting to dance until we felt the joy in our bones, but maybe the joy will never come until we put our old bones into motion first. Loving, serving, caring, friending and befriending. What if joy is the journey itself? And what if it's been there just underneath the surface the whole time? Can you hear it? The rhythm of love has a beat, and it's contagious. It's called joy, pure, unadulterated, deep, abiding joy. So may God surprise us today, friends, by opening our eyes to the joy that is already present underneath the surface of our life circumstances. Amen.